Our speaker in this session is Clint Bracknell, and he is going to be talking about recirculating Noongar language songs to enhance social cohesion. So I'll just turn it over to you.
Nice to be here, and thanks to the families and ancestors of this place for keeping it so lovely. I've titled this paper Recirculating Noongar Language Songs to Enhance Social Cohesion, rather than to enhance well-being or health, because I'm not trained in being able to define or really talk about health and well-being. So this is like a cop-out, and my idea of social cohesion is everyone getting along. So that's why I've used that term. So it's to emphasise that connectedness is integral to us being healthy and happy. There's some of my crew, on mum's side of the family at least, from the south coast of WA. I've been working with my family on language revitalisation since about 2010. And along the way, I've sort of taken on more responsibility over the years. To dive straight into it, and I'll try to just be nice and quick because I know everyone probably wants to get a feed. The United Nations Expert Group on Indigenous Languages has declared Indigenous language loss a global crisis, and this phenomenon is most prevalent in Australia, where just 13 of more than 200 Aboriginal languages are considered by academics to be strongly spoken today. Aboriginal language and song are intrinsically connected, while the integral relationship between language and song and culture and well-being is demonstrated in research and sort of vaguely acknowledged by the Australian government in statements stating that support for Indigenous culture and language is essential for closing the gap. Closing the gap being the government rhetoric around lower wealth and health and that sort of thing amongst Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples. Respondents to the most recent National Indigenous Language Surveys reported that they conduct language activities or language revitalisation in order to improve people's well-being and to help people connect with language and culture. And the Australian Human Rights Commission found that in Central Australia at least, connectedness to culture, family and land and opportunities for self-determination assisted with significantly lower morbidity and mortality rates. In Australia, as language and song are connected, and with some languages like Noongar, my language, it was originally sung as much as it was spoken. When we talk about Aboriginal languages, we're often talking about both speech and song. So the fact that I'm not a linguist and I'm talking about Aboriginal language, might be all right because I'm a music researcher or a musician. So that's how I justify my being here, I suppose. Highlighting the importance of song, ethnomusicologist Aaron Merritt argues that the endangerment of Aboriginal Australian musical heritage is tied to larger issues of health and well-being, education and social cohesions, and on a global level to issues that quite possibly impinge on the future of our survival as a species. Okay, so when I say Noongar, that's the area I'm talking about. Noongar is the Aboriginal language of a uniquely large urban/rural area encompassing Perth, the capital city of Western Australia, some of the nicest beaches in the world here included. Pretty great place. Over 35,000 people identify as being Noongar. Okay? So that's a big language group, potentially the biggest language group in Australia. And when you consider that in about 1900, there are only about 1,000 Noongar people. Noongar people are pretty effective at making their families bigger since 1900. Now the thing is with this area here, which is a very big area, Noongar people pretty much have no land. Okay, all this land here is farmland, national parks, or metropolitan sort of areas. Yes, so there's really limited access to land and to do things on land. There's extremely limited self-determination, and there's no sort of Noongar nation scale independent representative cultural body, something that exists independent of government, where Noongar people are sort of governing themselves or ourselves. So it makes things like immersion schools really difficult to even think about. What else makes it even more difficult is that the Australian Census has listed Noongar as a home language for just 163 people in 1996, 213 people in 2006, and 369 people in 2011. That's the most recent data I've got. I imagine that's gone up to probably close to 500. And that's just people who fill out a census form and say, yes, I speak some Noongar. Okay? So that might not mean like fluent speakers. That could just mean, yeah, I know like a handful of words. So this data is really potentially not reflecting that much at all. But our growing identification with the language, which is probably a result of committed community language revitalization efforts undertaken since about the 1980s. And these sort of numbers are consistent with similar efforts elsewhere in so-called settled Australia. Michael Walsh has written about this back in 2001. Limited exposure in schools has occurred in the southwest of Western Australia. And principals, like your school principal, will sometimes support it, sometimes take the language away. Marnie Roma Winmar is one of the best Noongar language teachers, and she's had to fight to stay teaching language. I think she's not teaching it anymore, and that's at a school that's all Aboriginal children in Perth. Okay, so it's a really difficult battle to keep language education in schools, and that's just primary schools. Haven't even thought about high schools. The most consistent language education program has probably been in the men's prison in Perth, which is kind of a worrying thing when you think about it. We've got the first Aboriginal language children's television program nationally in Australia, so that's sort of helped with raising awareness of the language. And there's been a few children's books produced over the years. Still less than 1.5% of Noongar people speak more than a few words of the Noongar language, most speaking a mix of Aboriginal English and Australian Standard English. There should be many more speakers, hence the need to find new community revitalisation and repatriation methodologies. Now this brings me to the tricky part of what I want to say. Noongar is a critically endangered language. Achieving fluency in a community of 35,000 people that are all spread out over this big area, where there's lots of Wadjalas that live there, is very difficult. So, if we're going to do the things that language revitalization seeks to do, which is improve this sense of identity, sense of cohesion, all this sort of stuff, cultural maintenance, what can we do that doesn't require fluency? And my very simple idea for this, and it's not a new idea, is, well, at the very least, all Noongar should have access to a repertoire of songs that are appropriate for them to learn, and that way they get to practice language. As so-called traditional songs are relatively stable examples of language use composed by fluent speakers, they at one level offer a means with which to engage with and practice Noongar language without singers needing to be fluent. Song is found to be effective in language learning as it functions as a mnemonic device and allows for almost subconscious rehearsal when we get songs stuck in our head. On another deeper level, songs function as powerful cultural texts. To sing is to nourish people and country. Still, there's little research on the dynamic interplay between song, language, and well-being in more urban, endangered language contexts, let alone in the Noongar language context. Cheryl Kickett Tucker found that youth in Perth, Western Australia, considered language to be the third most important component of their Aboriginal identity after sense of self, e.g. I'm a Noongar, and family. I'm part of a Noongar family. After that, I talk Noongar. I talk like a Noongar. Okay? So it's clearly important to young people, and Noongar community members involved in language revitalization workshops have often said it was good to gather around the stories of our old people rather than gather together at a funeral. Because usually funerals are the only time we see each other in a big group. So language revitalization provides an excuse for people to get together, hence the social cohesion argument. However, archival repatriation activities and attempts to revitalize language and song can be intensely emotional and sometimes overwhelming experiences due to trauma associated with forced assimilation and cultural loss. Aini Roma Winmar, and who I mentioned before, and Marnie Iris Woods are going to talk now about them being part of an on-country trip that we did, because a lot of the language stuff we do, it always involves going to sites that we're talking about.
And we call them Mama. And me and my sister have a special connection, very strong in spirit, as
yes.
Grandfather Tonga.
He actually raised my mother as well for a short time. And I got very emotional back there at the campsite. And you can't really explain it, you know, there's no explanation for why all of a sudden you're sort of all full. And I said to her, I just feel full. And like, what do you mean? Well, you can't explain. I feel full of tears. I feel full of joy. Like when you've been away from somebody who's been away for a long time and they've actually returned on a journey, and you rush out to meet them, and there's all these hugs and tears, and it's a joy, but you're shedding tears, and it's the same kind of thing that I sort of felt back there. Well, I'm still feeling it actually, you know. And being here with this mob, it's great, you know. But before my mother died, she had a massive stroke, and before she died, she said, "Romy, as soon as I get better, I'll take you back down to where I came from, and I'll take you all these places." And the project now has enabled me to come to these places, but without my mother. And I suppose it's sort of feeling the loss of her not being here, but yet maybe she is here in spirit, you know? And that dream sort of being fulfilled for me. So if I just, this happens, you know, take no notice. I'm feeling real, like I say, really, really good. And it's a spiritual journey. It's like Iris was saying, it's something that, you know, we'll never have an opportunity again. You know, walking this way, and it's something that I'll take back from my family, and so reinforcing this bond, the country.
And this is the only chance that we can give to, you know, share with our old people, and something picturesque, you know, on this tape that our children and grannies can look at. Because we can sit and yarn and talk to them, tell them about places where our old people have been, where we've been as youngsters, and it's hard for them to visualise. But I think even though you tell them about these places, it's important for them to see it.
Intergenerational transmission remains the biggest challenge for endangered languages and song traditions such as Noongar. In light of this, we've aimed to define ways to effectively mobilise a song archive as a means of cultural reconnection and empowerment, while encouraging and sustaining cross-generational engagement. By engaging Noongar people in a series of staged workshops to consolidate archival material and develop new song repertoire, we seek to reinvigorate and support Noongar singing practices. Throughout this process, we're examining the extent to which song can encourage the use of endangered Noongar language and address the core aims of language revitalisation, such as community development, maintenance of self-identity, and improved social cohesion and well-being. The first step in this mobilising process involves workshops conducted in line with the repatriation and revitalisation model employed by the Willimon Noongar Language and Stories Project. That's my family's little language project. The Willimon Project's repatriation and revitalisation model involves archival cultural material firstly being circulated with the original informants' senior descendants and their families, and then with gradually expanding and connected circles of Noongar people. Basing our plan on this successful model, we are beginning to conduct multiple staged workshops to mobilise and recirculate Noongar songs. Participants are gradually encouraged to perform, extend their repertoire, and create resources for future performances. In the future, we hope that more and more people can become invited into this process, but it's going to be done in a staged way where the right senior people are at the centre of things. The first step in this process has been the consolidation of a song repertoire from archival and sources from today. This has involved music analysis and interpretation. I don't say linguistics because I'm not a linguist, but nonetheless interpreting Noongar language. I've only been able to access and collect around 30 audio examples of Noongar song, but have located lyrics for another 70 or so songs. Working with all of this material initially requires close collaboration with senior Noongar people and cross-referencing with the many, many historical and modern Noongar word lists. This is most crucial when dealing with the written material, like this one here, as it's often been recorded with inconsistent orthographies and errors. So with this song, it's meant at the start, of the little note, it says Jebbing or Wulo song in brackets Curlew. So we think it's a song about the Curlew, right? Okay, and then we've got some more text. And so, but we're thinking all through this is a song about the Curlew, because hey, that's what it says there, Curlew in English. But then just to play you something. Oh, come on. Sorry, it's a bit too small. Nana Hazelbrand.
This is birds. Yeah. Most of your flying birds. That's a wally, that's an eagle. And that's a big eagle. Eagle, and that's a wallet, that's a big eagle. And Kulip, I say, that's a big chicken hook. And Kulip, that's a black diver to get a sweet scented Saturday. Wilo, it's a curlew. Warum, that's a black crow. Kulbari, that's the magpie. Mao is a melian. Wadi, that's a swan. Murit, that's pigeon. Chitty, that's a willy banker. And Chip, that's a red robin. And Novala, that's a black cockatoo. And Trinat is the king parrot. Kaur is a green buggy. Pirit, that's the one what you find is a little tiny bird, and he fly everywhere. Mostly you find him in the field and Jabron, that's a squeaker.
So Jabron or Jebbin, that's the squeaker, the Kuruwong, the shrike. Different bird. And Wulo, when Nana says Wulo, that's us, because remember I said Willowman before? Where people like the Bushstone Curlew. So he's got long skinny legs, very shy. Yeah. So you might have seen him around today, I don't know. Alright. Moving along real quick now. In terms of the well-being thing, I sort of tend to characterize as, you know, what makes us feel good, right? With my uncles, we went on a trip to try and retrace a songline through Fitzgerald National Park. And each of us brought our little skill. So I had a song related to this story. A couple of my uncles knew the story pretty well, and a couple of the other uncles knew this park very well. People haven't been allowed in this park for about 5 years. Okay, only the ranger. So we're very lucky to get access to it. Now, Nana Hazel remembered a place where you could see burnt dogs' footprints going into the water. So we're looking for that place. We didn't find it, though, this time. And then there was another place in the story where the dogs returned to the Noongar man as seals from the sea. And no one had ever seen this place. We just knew about it from the story. And because no one's allowed in this park, you know, no one living had seen it or knew where it was. But all of us men driving around in the troopies, bush bashing, and I'm in the back seat, all of us together, and we're humming the little song. we found it. We found that place. And it looks just like the picture that Nanny Ng painted of it. Just like that. She'd never seen it before. And I don't know if you can tell, but we felt pretty well then. So I don't know if song, you know, improves well-being, but we felt well. That's just so you know I'm an academic. I can do a bit of referencing at the end. Any questions? Yeah, nuts.
How long did it take you to find the site?
3 days. And that's a big area.
Clint, how are you distributing, recirculating the songs? You kind of hinted at it, but I didn't read between the lines. Though.
Yeah, so we've got this language organisation that since about 2008 or 7 has been doing stuff with the Gerhard Lars material. I don't know if you're familiar with that. So I've been starting with that, going through like these workshops that are organised through the family. So it's like Rob's family, Woods's, Williams's, all the families that are in the Lars. Going through the family, doing community workshop, get senior people first, and then they work through the archival stuff, then get more junior people in, and then take it out to like a Noongar community workshop sort of thing in the Noongar Centre in Alvin. So we've been doing the same things with the songs. We haven't got to the level where it's full community workshop. We've just been working with the descending group so far, but it's got to the point where you've got, say, that song about the dog one, Dog and the Seal story. There's a young man who's the great-grandson of George Nelly, who talked to Lars and told him that dog story. He's now singing the song to go with that dog story. So we're working with down that family line first, and then once we get it to a point where everyone feels comfortable performing, like we've got a critical mass, then share it with more Noongars and then take it out further and further. But at this stage, it's pretty slow going, and consolidation of the archives, the key sort of thing, because we want to have a clear idea of what these songs are actually about, where they fit in, and what protocols are around them before we, you know, go too far. So slow going now, but the basic theory that for critically endangered languages like this, that song's probably a good way to go, I think is proving to be true just in the few workshops we've done. A lot more participation in workshops and a lot more retention of language.
Just to follow on then, because it'd presumably be a fairly old form of the language.
Yeah.
And I understand that modern spoken Noongar is clearly reclamation language and is fairly... How are those differences? Are they like showing up to be major, or it's not troubling
major
people, or not troubling?
The good thing with the song is because the Noongar Language Centre and the people who have been doing Noongar language teaching in schools have come up with a standardised grammar that's quite different from the old Simmons document from 1838 or whatever. So the good thing about the songs is there's not much grammar. You'll have some verbs, some nouns, some adjectives, and there's not a part like the suffixes are there, and they're the same suffixes that are in the Noongar that people speak today mostly, and then you don't have to worry about your other little bits and pieces that have been added in to try and make it easier to teach in schools.
You expect a sign language, spoken language difference.
Yeah, yeah. So there is a fair difference between sign language and spoken language. I've written a paper about, or a chapter about it that will come out in a book that Miff Turpin's putting together.
Okay.
But yeah, for the purposes of this sort of thing, feeling good, getting people together, the differences aren't that great that it's going to cause too much hassle. Are you asking how do you sing the ones that are just written down? There's no musical notation, no audio?
Yeah.
So with the audio recordings, I've notated all of them, which is kind of a useless thing because I'm probably one of the only Noongars that can read them. So it's like, what's the point of notating? The point is that through writing it down in music notation, you can sort of try to understand better what's going on yourself. And in terms of, I've been trying to match up like the length of songs, shorter songs and longer songs to shorter songs and longer songs that are written, try to pick up different themes, try to pick up if it's a song that was composed by a man or a woman, is that going to make a difference? And then I'm trying to come up with almost like song genres. But there's only about 30 audio recordings of songs. Two of them I recorded myself, and they'd never been recorded before until last year. And the rest have sort of been like since about 1965 to about 2001. And each individual song has a different melody. There are similarities. So lots of descending melodies, like in a lot of Aboriginal music, there's an octave drop at the end of a lot of them, which is sort of common as well. So I'm just trying to map that to the written stuff and then come up with a few theories in terms of, well, what are some different sort of song styles. And that's the really tricky stuff. And that's why, you know, we haven't done much with the written material so far. We've mainly been focusing on the audio. Yeah.
How do you explain these differences in melodies?
Different song has a different tune. Well, I think the longer songs usually have the octave drop at the end. Different composers, I think composers have their individual style. I've even found there's one audio example of a song that's the same song, but seems to have like a jazz tune, like it's got the head, then it's got an improvisation bit in the middle, and then it returns to the head, if you know what I mean. And the two different singers sing the bit in the middle differently. So there's all sorts of weird things going on that have to do with individual singers, individual composers, songs style depending on topic and maybe region too. There's lots of things that could account for the differences.
Are there Western influences or are they like isolated?
The only Western influences I can really discern are the inclusion of English language, and that's in the written examples from the turn of the century, so 1904 to 1912. There are examples that have got English words in there, and you've got the substitution of English or new things in place of old things in, say, like a songline. So we've got a songline about a man travelling inside a whale, and then there's a song about a captain travelling inside a ship doing the same thing as the man inside the whale does. So you've got all these really interesting adaptations going on. And then with the audio stuff too, there's like a song where, you know, it's mostly English. There's only a couple of Noongar words, but the melody sounds more similar to the older Noongar songs than it does to any Western melody. Yeah.
I'd like to suggest that there's probably a different purpose for different songs.
Yeah.
Like within my culture, if it's a ceremonial tune, it's more chanty. And if it's a social dance song, it's more lively.
Yeah.
And one thing that, you know, you were trying to connect to was how this song promotes well-being. I think it definitely has a lot to do with well-being, because when I first started off teaching my kindergartners how to speak Hopi, it starts with songs. And like you said, the melody, the tune will stick in the head, and eventually comes the words. And then when you add visuals to the melody to describe what the words are saying, then if they hear that same word in a different song, they make the connections, these children. Oh, I heard that in this song that we sang last week. And so they start picking up the language that way, but it is a very powerful way of teaching language.
Yeah.
And I'm seeing that, you know, how much easier it is for me, because I can speak the language and I can understand the songs, but, you know, to see your situation and trying to figure out what they're all about.
Yeah, and the hardest thing is that they're written down by someone that doesn't really know the language that well and makes errors and doesn't and is not a linguist either, so the orthography changes.
Yeah.
One thing I have found, this is a theory, that the songs with the more simple melodies are meant to be group songs. The only audio recordings I've got are single men singing. So if you've got a song that's going, that, to me, that's a simple melody, that would imply that it would be good for a group song. Whereas something like, would be something that would be a solo song, because it would be too difficult to get a whole group in unison singing that. And that's just theoretical, and it's hard because we sort of got to reinvent the wheel. But yeah, you try and do it with a group, and if it's too difficult, oh, that's a solo song then.
Thank you very much, Clint. Thank you, everybody. I think it's time for the reception.